Dave Jensen, good evening.
Steel Wagstaff, how you doing?
Dave, I'm a little under the weather, but I'm so happy to hear your dulcet tones.
I see it. You're shedding clothes since I first seen you on the camera. Like, you're down to bottom shirt. Are we going shirtless tonight?
Or
are you,
I have something on above the waist just because modesty's sake. But what you can't see off camera is that I am a free man, Dave.
I'm so glad this is an internet-based show at this point.
Yeah, it smells amazing in this confined, soundproof room I'm in.
Steel, you brought a friend, all right? Yeah. Well, let's not go so far as call her a friend. This is a relative of some sort, correct?
That's true. I've got my sister-in-law, Jenny Bastian. She's joined us on the podcast tonight, Dave.
Hi.
I'm just excited you're here. This might mean that your wife will listen to this podcast. Do you think she'll listen in?
She probably will listen to the first third, and then we'll get to some topics that she's like, nope. Like, it depends on how you and I behave, Dave. It really does.
No, she'll listen to the end because I have something good to say at the end.
Okay. She'll kind of dip in and out.
Yeah, just,
she'll probably listen while she's cooking.
Tell her to fast forward through the Ask OTC section and then just go straight to the photography. I think that'll work for her.
She gave me some input on some of the Ask OTC questions, actually. I reviewed the show ahead of time with Laurel.
Oh, nice. So this is going to be good. We're going to do a good one tonight.
It's going to be great. So Jenny is a woman of many talents. But what I wanted to start with before we dive into that, the thing that has been on my mind lately are pets. Do you have them? Do you want them? Why, etc. And the first question that everybody needs to answer for themselves, I think listeners and our guests alike, is there is an age-old, really eternal battle. There are two kinds of people in the world. There are people who love cats, and there are people who love dogs. And I need to know where you stand on this age-old question. Dave Jensen.
When I was younger, I would have said dog. And even like 6 months ago, I would have said dog. But at this point, cat is low maintenance, comes to you for attention when it needs it, isn't bothering you the rest of the time. I'm on board. I'm finally a cat person. I'm ready.
You have enough things that require your constant attention in your life, you're saying? Enough help.
Yes, I don't want any additional responsibility, and it seems like a cat is going to limit that.
Good answer, Dave. Jenny, I don't know where you stand on this question. I figure probably half and half, but...
Well, I actually have a few thoughts on this. I think that most people think that I am a cat person, seeing as how I have three cats. However...
What they don't know is you have eight dogs.
What they don't know is that these cats require constant attention.
Oh, no.
They're all like having cats like most people think. One of my cats is very much like a dog and used to play fetch when he was younger. Unfortunately, he no longer does. I was entering him in some moments. But I really do. I love dogs. If I didn't travel as much as I do, I would have probably three dogs and three cats. And then no one would want to hang out with me.
So I'm thinking about this as, like, domesticated animals. And I was just reading recently, like, that dogs are the first animal by a long shot that we ever domesticated. Like, those and humans go way, way back so that we have these really tight bonds. And I don't really know the story of how humans domesticated cats and why. Was it the Egyptians? I feel like Egyptians were the people who had cats, but I'm just making that up.
I think that cats domesticated us.
Oh. Say more.
I don't have any history to back myself up. I'm just saying, I think it was them deciding we were going to take care of them.
So what's the principle of naming that you employ for your cats, Jenny? How have you chosen names? Any rules out there?
The first cat I had as an adult of 20 years old, who I still have, she is almost 17. I wanted her to sound like something delicious, so I named her Fritter. Frit, or Little Bear for short. And then with I have two little boy cats, black and white, tuxedo boy and a little orangey fluffy guy, and they're brothers, and they are Gustav and Little Red. I just wanted them to sound, one of them to sound regal and one of them to just be like very literal. So there is no pattern. Absolutely.
Dave, did you guys grow up with a family cat?
No. Pets were banned in my household for reasons I didn't understand until I had five children. And I'm like, yeah, I'm never having a pet. Like, I have way too much to do. I don't need to take a dog for a walk, too.
So I was going to ask who your best ever pet was, but it sounds like you've never had a pet. Is that real?
When I was 18, we got a dog. I was the youngest, and he was a little black dog with a goatee. He was adorable. My parents had him for years. Yeah, I liked him, Simon. So he's my best ever and worst ever because he's the only one we ever had.
Wow. Yeah, thinking back through my best ever pets, we didn't have a ton of pets. We had cats and like one or two cats for most of our life. And we also had dogs occasionally. When I was a little kid, we got a puppy for Christmas, and I had to follow these strings through all the house to find our presents. And at the end, in the laundry room, we had a puppy and a kitten. Well, the kitten first for my sister, and the puppy was for me. But it was a black lab, and his name was Spot.
They were on strings?
Yeah, my parents tied them up. No, there's strings, Jenny, the strings that went all through the house, and you had to follow the trail, and the string was tied to the basket in which the animals were in.
Okay.
So it was like a treasure hunt that led you to the cats. Yeah, it was bound hand and foot, and then we had to throw them into a pool of water to really toughen us up.
Oh, boy.
But yeah, that was probably for a while my best ever pet. I was like, I have a dog. I was so excited. But within like 6 months, it became a full-grown black lab. And then I was 8, and it was like, I have this wild beast who's much bigger than me. I couldn't take it on walks. It would like wrench my arm out of the socket. I couldn't play with it because it would just maul me. And so it was just an unhappy dog for a long time because my dad was like the only person in the family who could handle it. And eventually we found like a farm family and gave it to this farm family. Yeah, but we kept the cat, and so I really resented and hated this cat that my sister had because I was like, she got to keep her pet, but my dog we gave away. And
that's so sad.
So I probably
so does that still color your cat versus dog? So are you firmly dog still?
I have to say, probably I'm revealing. I mean, this is like deep psychotherapy. I haven't talked about this before, so thanks both of you for providing this platform for me. But yeah, I think I've got some unresolved dog issues, clearly. Some people have daddy issues.
I shouldn't be inviting you to watch my cats run out of town anymore.
No, I mean, you can. It's fine. I'll do it for duty and love, but I won't do it for, like, the joy of my childhood. I can't recapture those childhood joys. But if you had a black lab that was a little bit wild, I would like, live at your house. I would sleep on the floor with that dog.
I don't know that I'm ever going to have a black lab now.
No, it's a good call. Yeah, I'd be a little...
It's not a black lab, though. Has Laurel ever told you that?
No.
We had a black lab. I was in high school, and she was a beautiful black lab. Her name is Sadie. But she wasn't wild. She was just really angry at men in uniform. So, I mean, I guess that's a little wild. But she was very good with her cat, and she died on Valentine's Day. That was sad. Wow. Sorry. Brought it down a little.
That's like a short story right there. The dog also, who was mad at men in uniform and died on Valentine's Day.
Also, to bring it around to things we're going to talk about in a little while,
yeah.
Her death is the first death really the only death I've ever photographed.
Whoa.
Yeah.
We're going to definitely need to talk about that. But before we do, I want to know, quick hitter, who is your worst ever pet, or what was your worst ever pet?
I don't think I believe in that. Like, I literally don't. I could even say a pet is worst.
You never had a hamster then. That's clear.
I mean... I'm not going to swear right now. Don't make me swear about hamsters. I have never had rodents. Boy, that's not true. I had a squirrel for a day.
See, there you go. We just found your worst ever pet. If it lasted a day, it definitely sucked.
No. Because when you call the Wildlife Rehabilitation Center at the Humane Society of Milwaukee, and you say, you don't even say anything. You get to their voicemail and they say, if you are calling about a pet that you are trying to find a home for, call this number. If you are calling about a squirrel, please do not attempt to keep this animal as a pet.
Wow. They send the squirrel ambulance out and like assassinate it.
And I listened. I listened because I believe in authority of her.
Wow. So this is the potential to be the best ever pet, but the voice recorded answering machine from the Wisconsin Humane Society prevented you from it.
Squirrels are super aggressive when they hit adolescents.
When they hit adolescents?
Yes.
How old are adolescent squirrels?
13? I don't know. No, I have no idea how old they actually are, but they act like aggressively violent.
I'm learning way more than I bargained for already.
Well, don't ask me about dolphins then.
Okay. Dave, worst ever pet? I guess you said it was the one you had. What would be, in your imagination, the worst possible pet?
At this point, would be a large dog that I have to take on walks and clean up poop from. But no, the answer is hamster. We had some hamsters still. Like, they're the worst, yeah.
They just give you pink eye and, like, diseases and stuff.
And they die when you're out of town and, like, the whole house smells because your hamster's dead.
We had a hamster that we were babysitting or, like, hamster watching. And we went on vacation, and it got out of its cage, and it chewed up the cable that connected the fridge, the water to the fridge, and it flooded our whole house. My parents were so pissed. You know, the little water cable behind your fridge.
Yeah.
So that was probably our worst ever pet.
Hamsters are just the worst. Don't get a hamster. That's the take-home message from this podcast today.
Yeah, that's our PSA. Now, Jenny's face is frozen in the face of, like, extreme shock and disgust. Are you still with this, Jenny? Jenny, did the hamster push you over the edge there?
Yeah. It was the smell, really.
All right. Well, we have a lot packed in the show. We talked a little bit about pets. I know we could go for years and years. Jenny, you are an animal expert of all the people I know. You know more about our other species friends than anybody. But we've got a lot to cover. The first thing that we are going to do, listener questions have been piling up for months. I mean, we get thousands of emails.
Insane amounts. Yeah.
So we're going to do an Ask Off the Chain. This one's an Illinois edition. We're going to throw some love to our many, many listeners from Illinois. Ask a bunch of questions from those people. We're going to do an expert testimony. Ask the artist. Jenny is a illustrious photographer. We're going to talk to her about the photographic arts.
That's exciting.
Yeah. Because luster, light, you know, illustrious. That was my little play on words there.
Well, luster is the surface of a paper as well.
See? Educate me. And then we're going to do some Unchained Melodies and Book Wisdom. But first, we want to start with Ask Off the Chain. This is from Jill in Shelbyville, Illinois, one of our favorite moderately sized towns. She says, guys, and Jenny, why do you think Don Johnson's career never really took off after Miami Vice? Any theories?
I think Jill's just showing her ignorance. I got two words for you. Nash Bridges.
I was thinking the same thing, Dave. Friggin' Jill. Does she not get syndicated cable TV or whatever? I mean, freaking Nash Bridges.
No, he's on CBS for like a decade. Don just kept coming. I never actually watched the show, but I assume it was really, really good because it's got Don Johnson in it. And second point, Harley Davidson and the Marlboro Man, one of the best movies I've ever seen, starring Don Johnson as the Marlboro Man.
What?
Yeah.
Please expand on this.
Well, there was another man that dressed up as a motorcycle, and Don Johnson rode him around. It was very homoerotic. late night movies. Dave was really into it.
To be able to maintain your masculinity while doing that, it was just an impressive feat.
Well, he was
Don Johnson, 5 o'clock shadow.
So what I want to know is, what is the wardrobe like on Nash Bridges? I know what it's like on Miami Vice. I think everyone knows.
Okay, so this show ran from 96 to 2001. It had Cheech from Cheech and Chong as his co-star.
Cheech Marin.
Yeah, and it had Yasmin Bleeth from Baywatch for a couple of years. So
you can just
kind of put two and two together and sort of guess as to what the wardrobe was like. But I will say a lot of banded collar shirts, button-up vests, pinstripes kind of carpet-looking suits, you know, like Da Vinci painting ties, silk ties.
Okay, I just looked at a photo on a smartphone.
Yeah.
The white pants are still there.
Yeah, oh yeah, linen.
That's what I want to know. Oh, so, I don't think that's linen.
Oh, wasn't linen? Okay, gabardine?
Probably polyester, let's be real.
There's a lot of vests in these shots. Like, Don Johnson really found his calling, and that was vest wearing. So Jill, he's got a vest, man. He's done well for himself, I think.
I mean, Jill, think about it next time you write us with a question. Don Johnson's career never took off. Okay, this one's from Barney in Decatur, Illinois. You ever been to Decatur, Jenny?
Only in the song of Sufjan Stevens.
All right. Well, I haven't been either, but this is from Barney. He lives there. He says, hey, guys, you ever caught any Pokemon? And which one do you think is the most elusive?
I've never caught one. Jenny, have you caught one?
No, I don't do that kind of thing, unfortunately. However, I will say that the library I work at, the Fitchburg Public Library.
The Fitchburg Public Library.
And not in Massachusetts, the one in Wisconsin. It's a gym to the Pokemon players. I think that's where they fight.
Hold on. The library is a gym?
The library is a gym. And people take their Pokemon there to, like, fight them against each other.
Nice.
And that seems important to them. And I've seen people walk around staring at their phones, you know, looking for the Pokemon. I know where one is. It's by this big cow. This, like, statue of a cow.
It's permanently there? I don't know either.
I don't know how to check.
So I don't know much about the Pokemons, but I do know that our sister-in-law, who we really should have on the podcast, is a level 47 Pokemon hunter. She's really good. She's a lawyer in Madison, Megan Henneke. And she has a Tumblr that she's about to start in which she compares prominent Pokemon characters that she's caught with real-life famous people. So she's got it all mapped. She's got, like, a Donald Trump Pokemon.
I love the Michelle Obama one. It's like some Pokemon that looks like a pony. Really beautiful and elegant, but, like, fierce.
Yeah. She's done a lot of thinking about this. This is going to take over the internet as soon as she figures out how to Tumblr.
But she's done thinking about it, but it's so immediate for her. She's like, oh, yeah, that one's Joe Biden. Oh, that's Giuliani. Like, she just knows.
She's a savant. She's a savant, Barney. So, Barney, we'll hook you up via email with Megan, and hopefully all your dreams will come true there on Pokemon. This is a question. This is a little bit kind of a more of a conceptual one. It might strike close to home for those of you who have been in grad school for a long time. This is from old Marky in Bloomington, Illinois. He says, hey, would you move to Barrow, Alaska if, for example, they were going to pay you $135,000 to work there and pay off your student loans, plus you get 41 days of vacation yearly?
I need to know how many sun lamps there are.
As many as you can fit in on your $135,000 a year budget. Barrow is known for the northern, this is the northernmost town in the United States. It's, I think, in the Arctic Circle. Population of a couple thousand.
I say do it, Marky. Like, what else? You live in Bloomington. I'm sure that's a nice enough town. But, like, what do you have to lose?
Your student debt. That's one thing.
Boom. 41 days vacation. That's a lot of dog sledding that you could do. There's just a lot of opportunity.
Relive Northern Exposure for those of us that love that show.
Another great idea. Now, that question was surprisingly precise. I feel like Marky's got an offer in his back pocket. He just needs a bit of validation. And I just want to say, Marky, you know what? YOLO. YOLO, Marky. So do it. The next question comes to us from one of the great sister cities, twin cities in the United States. This is from the Champaign side of Champaign-Urbana, Illinois. It's from Jerome, who said, hey, if you were conducting a draft of presidents to form a tag team wrestling team, who would you pick?
This one's really hard for me because I don't think anyone ever taught me their brawn, their level of brawn.
Well, let me answer that question for you then. Easy choice.
Not Delano Roosevelt?
No. I mean, he could be a good heel, maybe. He'd be the promoter, kind of, the Weasley's, you know, oily guy. And then at the end, he gets out of the chair, and they're like, he's not crippled after all. But I think the good choice would be you got to have Taft, and you got to have Teddy Roosevelt. They would be unstoppable.
Teddy's number one pick. Like, Teddy is number one pick. Taft, I want to see if he's agile or if it's just mass, because you've got to be able to move. You can't just stand there. This is wrestling. You have to move.
You'd want a Jimmy Carter.
I don't know. Maybe
oil him up.
I was about to say Jimmy Carter.
Covered
I'd like
in
to
peanut
see
oil
Jimmy out there.
Yeah,
and like people are thinking maybe Kennedy because he's young, but he was kind of frail man. So you don't want him out there.
He was just pretty.
Yeah, and James K. Polk or Zachary Taylor. I think both of those guys were probably pretty lithe and supple.
Supple.
That's what you're looking for in a wrestler, like Jenny. You got to look for how supple they are, how supple their limbs are.
Muscles oil up.
But I think Lincoln, with his tenacity and his beard,
great finishing.
Yeah, you could
too.
Rub that beard into your opponent's face; it'd be really, really bothersome.
I heard he was really lethal off the top ropes, Lincoln.
Wasn't he very tall? Like, how tall was he actually compared to normal people at the time?
I think I heard he was something like 7'2".
7'2", 350
He could bench probably, what, like 4'10"?
4'4".
4'4". That disembodied voice was comment of the night. There we go.
Gallery.
Jenny's a ventriloquist. She's got a puppet on her arm there.
Yeah. So Jerome, consensus is you got to have Teddy on your team.
And then it doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter who you picked second.
Because no one's going to take him down.
No, he's going to march up a hill and march back down again. Isn't that what he did?
I think Rough Riders, yeah. Yeah. Rough Riders, now that would be an amazing tag team name.
Yes.
But he would, I'm thinking about Teddy Roosevelt, he would never tag out.
No. He's so red.
So his partner could totally be FDR, because FDR is just sitting there watching Teddy go.
The
yeah.
Roosevelt Rough Riders. That'd be good. They'd be like fake brothers. That'd be awesome. That'd be really, we should do that. As soon as we get our cryogenic powers back up to speed, let's bring him back to life and make him pro wrestlers.
Or just time machine. Yeah.
That works.
Whatever technology comes first, we take advantage of it.
Hey, so we have a really burning question. Jenny, I think you're going to have to weigh in on this as a living expert on the topic. Theophilus from Normal, Illinois writes, who's the greatest television detective in your lifetime?
Okay, I wish that I could show your listeners the notes I made about this topic. Because I have a list. Oh, wait, it's like underneath my computer. Just have the heat from my computer from burning my legs. I have a list of 6 shows. I think you, Steele, probably know which one is at the top of my list. But probably your listeners do not.
But if Magnum PI is not at the top of your list, this list is a sham, and we should stop the podcast now. But go ahead.
Hey, you can stop the podcast, Dave.
Private investigator would be a different question. They asked about television detective.
Every single one of the... Well, no, okay. Two of the people on this list of 6 shows, 2 of the people are police detectives.
Yeah.
There are 5 other people that are not. So, but I feel like Magnum P.I. is just like a given. Like, it's just kind of easy. So, I mean, he's got the Hawaiian shirt and everything.
Mustache, chest hair.
The other thing, though, Dave, you're going to be disappointed because Magnum's not on the top of the list, but all 6 of the people that Jenny lists do have incredible mustaches. So go for it, Jenny.
Wait, but side note. Have you seen the thing that's about Magnum PI and is it Han Solo? Where then someone compared Magnum PI and Han Solo to the Chipmunks show that's like, you know what I'm talking about at all?
No. You gotta keep going because my interest is peaked, but I have no idea.
There was a show in the 90s about these chipmunks. I don't think I ever saw it.
Alvin, Simon, Theodore. Yeah, we know the chipmunks.
Nope. It's these little chipmunks. Oh, God. I'm just embarrassing myself now. I give up. I'll find it, and do you have a link on your blog? I can put it on or something. But there's like a little, it's like a meme.
But it's Han popular. Solo, Magnum P.I., and 3 chipmunks?
No, it is that the chipmunk relationship of this television show is actually the definition of these 2 characters that were unrelated in real life.
Does this involve an audio tape recording made by the Department of Welfare and Animal Services in the state of Wisconsin or something like that as well? Is there something about chipmunks?
No, squirrels.
Squirrels, okay. Well, in any case, Jenny, drum roll, please. Number 6, the 6th best TV detective of your lifetime.
This one might surprise you. I'm just going to go ahead and say Remington Steele.
Oh, hey, love the name. Love the name. Pierce Brosnan.
Is that Pierce Brosnan? Yeah. A young Pierce Brosnan.
Very young. I fail to remember his lady sidekick's name, which makes me feel bad.
Yeah. She was just eye candy anyway.
No, she's got some brains, too.
Well, Pierce is the eye candy. Come on.
Exactly. But she did have a lot of blue eyes, though. And then the A-Team.
Number 5. The A-Team. That's
the entire team.
Yeah. The entire team. They were amazing.
Face, B.A. Baracus, that other guy.
Murdoch.
Murdoch.
I had like a big crush on all of them.
Wow.
Okay. Then let's go to Keggy and Lacey.
Yeah.
The only I know you don't like a date, do you?
No, no. But keep going. Let's not focus there.
Let's go to Columbo.
Okay, another legitimate. Thing. Another thing.
I love Peter Falk. I love him.
His best role was in Princess Bride.
I disagree with you. He was in
obviously, because I'm lying. I'm really lying, Jenny.
Okay.
he was in it for like 2 minutes.
So then I have to go to a personal favorite, which you will both probably hate, Moonlighting with Sybil Shepherd and Bruce Willis.
We would potentially hate it if we had heard of it.
Of course I've heard of it. I'm grateful to it because it launched Bruce Willis's amazing career. And so it'll always have a special place in my heart. I've never watched it and never will, but thank you, Moonlighting. You gave me Bruce Willis.
Exactly. I have very few memories of it. However, I remember that it taught me what sexual tension is. And
which has come in handy for the remaining 30 years of your life.
Exactly. That's remaining. I hope there's more.
No, I mean like the subsequent 30, the last 30 years. Thanks, Sybil Shepherd.
Also, we named our cat that we got on my 7th birthday, Maddie, after Sybil Shepherd's character. And wow. Then,
okay, so what number are we at? I forgot. I lost track.
We're at number one, guys.
Number one.
Oh, boy.
Number one. Okay, Theophilus, are you ready for this?
It's Jessica Fletcher, guys. It's from where she wrote.
Dave doesn't know who that is. Dave just, it's like Jessica Fletcher. A woman? I didn't know a woman could solve crimes, Dave saying.
I mean, clearly, Cabot Cove is the murder capital of the world.
Dave also doesn't
get every week
that
there's another murder? Like, is there like 70 murders that she solves over time or more?
Well, once in a while she travels to somewhere exciting. And then her nephew is there with her.
The thing is, there's an elderly woman who lives in a relatively small town, and 50-something people die in her town over the course of several weeks. The last episode, and I don't remember if you saw this one, Jenny, but what was revealed was she had framed every previous murder suspect, and in fact, she was one of the largest serial killers in history. She herself had killed 70-something people.
I must have missed that one.
But it's
there's only one that dot that connects to every single crime. It's Angela Lansbury. She's been at the scene of every single murder.
Yeah, it surprisingly took people a long time to get that, but
I somehow missed that part.
Yeah, well,
she just didn't have as impressive as a mustache as Tom Selleck.
That's true.
Yeah, I'm surprised Jenny didn't go with Monk. I thought you were a big Monk fan.
You know, someone once compared me to his sidekick, but I've never seen that show, so I have no idea if that was an insult or not.
Probably. Anyone who watched Monk a lot, probably you would instantly defriend them, is my guess there, Jenny.
No, I really don't know. Maybe I would love it. I haven't seen it.
What an open mind. All right, here's a question. We've got from Sandra, the old Romeoville, Illinois. She says, what's the deal with deep dish pizza? Is Chicago style supposed to be a compliment or an insult, generally? And that was a kind of thoughtful question. I'm like, when you describe something Chicago style, does that generally carry a marker of like quality or like, okay, walk away? What's your feeling about?
So Chicago style, you're telling me it's a very specific kind of very deep dish pizza. And I enjoy it. It's great. It's not something you want to have every time you have pizza. But if you're in the mood for Chicago style, like sit down and wait.
The question, Dave, not about pizza. I'm thinking about as an adjective or an epithet generally.
Okay.
If someone says like Chicago style X, it doesn't matter what. Are you thinking like, oh, that's better than regular X? Or you're like, oh, no, I'd much rather have just regular X.
I feel like it's regular X, but somehow hot dogs are involved.
Because I feel someone says like Mediterranean or West Coast X. I'm like, yep, I want it. Someone says like New York X. I'm like, it's probably going to be assholes involved. And then if Chicago style, I don't know what my emotional resonance is for this.
It should just be like, hey, all right. Yeah, I'll eat a hot dog.
Yeah, I still will eat a hot dog, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I lived in Chicago for 7.5 years. I had my share of deep dish pizza. It almost always made me want to cry because I would get so tired. It's just like a pile of sleeping pills. Really. That's what it's like. And some tomatoes on top. But
I wonder why I never see that on the ads in the big billboards. Like, Chicago pizza, a pile of sleeping pills with tomatoes on top. Seriously, there's a whole segment of the market that would be like driving to the nearest deep dish pizza joint to get those.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Chicago-style driving's not so good. Chicago-style pizza's not so good. But a lot of other things in Chicago are wonderful.
Chicago-style politics.
Well, you know why they call it the Windy City, right? So Milwaukee's actually a windier city, miles per hour.
Oh, however, really?
However, Chicago is the Windy City because it's so changing in the political winds.
I think we've got a Milwaukee booster on the show here, Dave. Can you tell she's a plant?
Oh, can I tell you something exciting that you may have seen on the internet already
Please.
Today? This is totally unrelated, except it's having to do with Milwaukee and libraries, which are both close to my heart. The Milwaukee Public Library System has decided to forgive all fines if people will come to the library in person.
Wow.
And I think that's a really amazing decision.
It's like a library amnesty.
It is. I think it's really amazing.
That's great.
Yeah. You're not going to find Chicago doing that. No way. No how.
Like, you show up in our library, we're going to give you two black eyes.
A Chicago-style beating.
You know, corollary to this, while we're on the subject of amnesties, we're talking about Chicago-style pizza. I propose that pizza delivery drivers be given lifetime immunity from traffic tickets and traffic violations. Like, all of their speeding tickets, all their parking violations should be forgiven if you find out that they were on a pizza delivery mission.
Like, doesn't that happen to UPS and FedEx drivers? They're immune, right?
Yeah, and they're just carrying packages. What could be more important than a steaming hot pizza?
Ice cream.
People taking their pregnant partners to the hospital and pizza delivery drivers. Those should be the two protected classes of drivers in the United States.
I'd vote for it. If this is your single platform and you're running for president, I think you're getting a good percentage of the vote.
It's the pizza delivery party. And that would be a great party, by the way. Okay.
That would be good.
Jenny, somehow word leaked out that you were going to be on the show. And this is a question from our friend Hobo Pete from Tent City.
Huh.
Oh, yeah.
He said, suppose you lost all your teeth and had to replace them with some other kind of substance. What would you want your new false teeth to be made of? Colored glass, right? Also, hey, Jenny.
Is your listening public need to know who Hobo Pete is?
I think so. I mean, they're pretty up on pop culture references. They're into the art world.
Yeah.
So I had a dream once about a man in Hobo Pete. And he wanted to show my artwork in the gallery, but he was also a hobo. So that's about as far as it goes.
It was a train car gallery, Dave.
It was.
But he kept showing up to her art shows to drink all the wine, I think. He was like a wine bum.
Yeah, I mean, I think he was hitting on me, too. But that, you know, that's clearly a dream. Because Hobo Pete, he's got ladies around the block for him.
Yeah. So that's an important question, though. If you lost all your teeth and had to replace them with a different substance, as a male nurse, Dave, what would you recommend?
Well, the answer is gold. With each tooth having a diamond in the middle of it, so
soft and hard. You can go for. I mean, yeah, that's nice.
Like pudding or apple, whatever you want to eat, you're good.
It's bling and bling.
I feel like, man, what would I want teeth replaced out with?
Marble.
Ooh.
I would like marble.
That's kind of cool.
How about marble taken from the statue, the David? Michelangelo's David, like that'd be nice marble.
You know, I saw that in person, and it was really beautiful, but it looks basically the same as the mimic, you know, the copy that's outside of the building.
Friggin' Michelangelo. Jenny, that guy was so unoriginal. Good point, Jenny.
That's a terrible point. Like, of all the art I've ever seen in person, like, I really was emotionally impressed when I saw the David. Like, I thought, like, whoa, this totally lived up to the hype. And, like, if I ever lost my teeth, I would want them made by part of it with the statue.
And Jenny, just to highlight this, Dave has been to one art museum, and he was only there for 15 minutes. So it's not like he's got a lot of comparison points. But he did see Michelangelo's David, and it was in Vegas, right? Isn't that where that's located?
Yeah, the Bellagio, right?
Yeah.
With the leaves, definitely.
Yeah. His gold loincloth was real impressive the day that Dave happened to be there. This is the last question that we're going to ask today, and this comes from our Rockford, Illinois. Lucille writes and says, hey, whatever happened to ball pits in children's play areas, and how can we bring them back?
Important question.
I don't know. I don't know what this means. Can you? I don't know. There aren't any more ball pits.
Jenny,
there's no more ball pits.
Did you not have a childhood?
I lived on 2 acres of greenery. I didn't have a ball pit.
All right. So city folks would sometimes go to like Chuck E. Cheese or to McDonald's, and there was a big pit full of like lightweight plastic balls that you could just jump in and get lost in.
I thought you meant like a ball field.
Oh, the old ball pit. To play baseball, the old ball pit.
Oh, boy.
You have to fight your way out.
Okay, Chuck E. Cheese.
No one leaves until someone's bludgeoned to death with this bat. Get in the ball pit, kids.
It's got to be about sanitation, right?
Yeah, but that's stupid. There's lots of unsanitary things that people do.
That's true.
But anytime you go into a ball pit, like you were coming out with an extra Band-Aid that you didn't go in with, like every time. So that's the issue, Lucille. But what I think we have to do is they've come up, there's technology now where you can put coatings on things that are actually antibacterial. There's phones in the hospital that have like this special plastic antibacterial coating. If we just put that on the balls in the pit, everybody's back in, everybody's having a good time.
Antimicrobial balls, and then kids can play there safely.
But I thought there was just another group of things in the media about how the antibacterial stuff's not good for you.
Yeah. It's a sham, Dave, but sorry.
Guys, first of all, I'm a doctor of nursing. Second of all, yes, a lot of the antibacterial soaps. I'm talking about the technology. This is a futuristic technology.
Yeah, so it must be real and good.
It's a coding.
It's obviously good, and it's futuristic.
Okay. I've been one over.
You can't put futuristic in front of something unless it's real and good.
It's like the anti-Chicago style. Like, you got Chicago style on one hand. Futuristic? Yeah, I'll go futuristic, you know? Okay. Well, we nailed some questions. Illinois, your questions have been answered. You're welcome. Come back to us next time, Michigan. We'd love to hear from you, Michigan. We're excited to answer your questions on our next Ask OTC. The moment everybody's been waiting for, and we put it off long enough, it's time to ask the artist, Dave.
Mm-hmm.
We have in our presence a practitioner of the ancient...
Of arts?
I was going to say ancient art, but it's the important art of photography.
Futuristic art?
The futuristic art of photography. Yeah, the futuristic art of photography. So the first question for you, Jenny, that we want to know is, what's going on in your art practice right now? Next show, where can people see your work and what's happening?
Well, I live in Madison, and I have a show coming up in November and December at the Bubbler, which is a part of the Central Public Library in Madison. It's an art-making space and a maker space, and has recently won a bunch of awards. It's a really wonderful library. And so I'm working on a project that is going to be displayed there, and has a current, like, little installation there. So the project, I take a lot of photos. I decide what the themes of those photographs are. I then make a survey about those themes, whatever it is, like an emotional experience or something of that kind. And then I ask people about their experience of that. And then I make an archive of that and display it. So this time, I'm working on a project about fear. I'm asking people what their experience of fear is, and I'm going to then display that at the library. So I have to say,
Jenny, last week we had Spencer on the podcast, and he was telling Dave that he ran into you at the library.
Oh.
and was filling out your survey about fear and was very, said to say hello, and he was very excited for the show and was very interested.
Oh, that's so nice.
So yeah. Word's getting around all over Madison.
Right. I'm so glad. Yeah, I've been actually getting a ton of responses from the library. So I made this little nook on the landing between the first and second floor of the library where I have a little table set up and people can fill out the survey there in person. And we ran out of pages so quickly that people were filling out the postcards and folding them in half and putting them in the little box. I actually had a woman, so the library that I work at, they allowed me to have a pile of postcards in the vestibule on either side of the entrance of the library. A woman called the reference desk where I work to ask for me, to talk to me about how it affected her. It was really quite amazing. She had answered anonymously, but wanted me to know, wanted me to be able to contact her so she could know when the event was happening, like an opening event.
Wow.
It was a really incredible experience about fear in her life, and shared it and was looking for an outlet for this thing to share. And had a very traumatic experience that she wanted to share. So it was really amazing. Someone called me and talked about it. It's great.
So what kind of questions, what does your survey entail? What are you trying to get from people?
It's always three questions, and they're very simple. The first question usually defines the subject. So fear is the subject. I ask the question, what is fear? The second question is, what are you afraid of? And the third question is more of a request to tell a story about fear, how fear has affected your life.
Okay. Do you have any, like, responses that have stood out to you so far that you'd want to share or talk about?
I mean, some of the ones that I have been really short are appealing to me, where people just say, like, I'm afraid of other people, or I'm afraid of failing, or, and people that are just like very clear about what is frightening to them. But the woman that I spoke with on the phone today, her husband abused her, beat her for basically 2/3 of her life. And she decided finally to leave him and made it happen. And she hasn't spoken to anybody about it.
Wow.
And then decided to share this with me in an anonymous way. So that was really amazing.
So Jenny, I feel like you've talked about this as like a practice for you, a couple of your shows, where you take an emotional experience and the photographs are curated around it, and then you're inviting participation and comments, that you make an archive of people's feelings about this thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to know a little bit of, like, if you'd speak to it, if you feel like what is your philosophy of art, or your approach to taking pictures? And like, there seems to be this social or this public component that doesn't seem typical to me of what I experience of, like, the typical photography show.
I would say that my daily practice has to do with photography. Yeah, so, like, on a regular basis, I'm photographing, and I shoot on film still. I use a little Canon AE-1 program. And then 6 months later, I might see those photos when I finally process them. And then once I process them and look at them, I can sort of discover what the themes are in them, what I was dealing with in my life then. But I think that the thing that I am most interested in is social practice. And that's a very sort of amorphous term, but it has to do with community for me. And I want to learn from my community, and I want my community to grow. And in order to learn from that community, you have to reach out to them. And so that's what these surveys do, is they reach out to a community that I don't even have yet. You know, there's people that I haven't yet met, but have something to offer, and I want to learn from them, and I want to connect them to each other.
Cool. A lot of the artwork that I work with, I guess the literary work, is a very private experience. You have a private reading experience. Mm-hmm. There's a possibility, I think, for, like, social engagement through art, or the production of a community who's experiencing an art or artwork, or who's been changed by that art. I don't think I've thought about it as carefully, clearly, as you have, about the ways that you're intending to use your art practice to produce community. And that's a really, I think, beautiful idea.
I think it seems really simple to me. I want to be connected to people. This is the way, these are the things that I'm good at, and this is how I can connect to them.
Huh.
Let me ask you just about, technical technique. So do you use film, and how are you processing? How are you creating the actual photographs?
So I shoot film on my little camera, I usually use Fuji when I can. It's my favorite. They're not paying me to say this, unfortunately. I send all my film to a lab in Austin, Texas called Holland Photo, and shout out to them because they're amazing. A friend of mine used to work there, so that's how I found them. But they are great. They do such a wonderful job, and they're really reasonably priced. So that's where I get my film developed, and I actually don't get anything printed unless I'm doing a show. And then I rescan things at a higher resolution to make sure it's all in great shape. And then I send it to be printed. And there's a few different labs that I use, depending on where the show is. But I prefer to do not inkjet prints. I will do them if I need to, but I prefer digital C prints, which are produced from a digital and larger head onto C print paper, if that makes sense.
Not to me, but
I don't know,
I'm sure the
words
are real.
Why use film as opposed to the digital cameras?
Because, yeah, Jenny, you also have a photography business where you shoot weddings and stuff, and all that stuff you shoot digitally, right? So you do work in both.
I do, and I use them each for very different purposes. I'm old enough that I started shooting weddings on film, so I know what that's like. I know enough about it to know that shooting digital for weddings is much easier.
Sure, yeah.
Shooting film because you know what you got. Film and digital are very different animals, and not just because one is tangible and one is intangible until you print it, but simply how the light is recorded onto a piece of film rather than recorded onto a memory card. When I was learning how to take photos, it was shoot for the shadows, print for the highlights. With digital, it's not that simple. It's much harder for me. And I think that some people who are maybe born digital, you know, like digital native, maybe it is easier for them. I don't care enough about digital if I'm revealing too much about myself. I don't care enough about digital to really be super amazing at it.
So I've never realized this, but have you ever exhibited photographs in an art show that you shot digitally?
Yes.
Oh, you have? Okay.
Yes. For my MFA show.
But generally, no. It's everything that you'll show in an art practice is film.
Everything on my website is film, and everything in my photo website, my business website, is digital.
Wow, I didn't know there was such that clear delineation in your practice. That's really interesting.
Well, I'm sure part of it is simply that I want to have a separation in my mind, you know, between business
and art. Yeah. So, Jenny, you also, you mentioned Chicago. You went to the Art School of Chicago for your BFA in photography, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Schofield Institute.
And then you got an MA and MFA at University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee in photography. Mm-hmm. So you spent a lot of time in art school learning the art of photography.
That's true.
In hindsight, was art school worth it? What did you learn?
So a lot of people have asked me this question, and I've talked to a bunch of different high school students about it when they're sort of thinking about whether they want to go to art school. What I would say is my education was completely worth it. And I'm talking specifically about my undergrad education, completely worth it. I would not have been as prepared conceptually or technically for graduate school and beyond if I had not gone to the school I went to. However, if you don't have the means to do it financially, other schools are fine. Going to community college for 2 years until you can save up the money to go for another 2 years at an art school, it's fine. People are going to learn what they're ready to learn. I was ready to learn conceptual art at that time. And I did, and it was a great experience. And I do feel like I was more prepared for the world because of it. Do I have a lot of debt? Yeah, it sucks. It's terrible. But
you can get that debt in lots of ways, right, Dave? I mean, you can get it by dropping out of law school and by going to nursing school for a long time. I mean, you can develop student debt lots of ways, not just art school.
Yeah, there's lots of opportunities for student debt. Yeah.
I can also go to Alaska and work that debt off real quick.
Yeah, or you could have five kids and then never dig yourself out.
Sure.
You just keep having more children, and eventually the children will pay the debt. I think that's our plan.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, here's another question. Art school, if you've only watched, like, movies, is it all cocaine and nihilism all the time?
So I would say art school, specifically in the photography department, art school is at least one person in class photographing themselves naked or with their head shaved every week.
Nice. Yeah, it's good you can get some critiques of those.
There's so much. I mean, I was considered very tame in art school. And, I mean, I think I am pretty tame, probably. But I was like, people were not, they thought I was so boring. But it's like shaved heads, nudity, dominatrix stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, how can you be serious about your art without shaving your head or photographing yourself naked? Is that possible?
Exactly. No.
If Dave were to rotate his camera like 40 degrees, you should see the stuff he's got on his living room wall there. Some serious leather nudes.
Leather nudes, yeah. Yeah, I mean, art school is a fun place, but it's a really amazing place. I feel very lucky to have gone to art school. And also, I will say, the people that I met in that school, I'm still so close to so many of them. And so in terms of community, which is so important to me in my art practice and in my personal life, that has been a huge bonus.
Yeah, I can see the art school friendships have been like lifelong friendships for you. And that's a really...
Oh, yeah.
Everybody has different college experiences, but it sounds like it was like perfect for the kind of life you wanted to build. Yeah.
Yes. Okay.
So a quick question for you about, based on what you know about Dave and I, recommend a photographer that we should check out, someone that we should look into.
So I've thought about this. Dave, I know very little about you.
Thomas Kincaid is his favorite artist currently.
Whoa, really? Yeah. So
of course, yes.
So far from it.
And a big Gary Larson fan, too.
No, so what I chose for you, Dave, was Robert Frank. Are you familiar?
I'm not familiar, no.
He knows Robert's sister, Lisa.
I know Gary Frank, Incredible Hulk artist, fantastic comic artist.
Those siblings are very talented, that Frank family.
They're maybe cousins. Robert Frank is an incredible photographer. He's still alive. He is still alive.
So good.
He's amazing. He did this really incredible project. He was born in Switzerland. He did this really incredible project called The Americans, about what the world of America is like. He came to America thinking very highly of it, being sort of very caught up in the dream of America, and then discovering that it wasn't so simple. And his documentation of the American dream and world is exceptional.
So yeah, I'm just looking through some pictures here. It looks like a lot of portraits and black and white, and yeah, I enjoy it. My wife loves photography. She would really like, I think, this guy's work.
I also think if you do like Robert Frank, Richard Avedon is someone that is very different conceptually, but has a similar love of portraiture and the American dream also.
All right, Jenny, enough about Dave. Tell me what I should like.
Sebastião Salgado.
Sebastião Salgado. I don't know who that is yet, so help me.
Brazilian.
Okay.
His work is very much about social issues in Brazil and around the world, and also nature.
Cool.
And every single picture he's ever taken is of himself in the nude, just in different locations. That's right, right?
It's like a Where's Waldo, but it's Where's Sebastião.
Exactly. Ooh, that's exactly what it is.
You can tell we're very serious art critics, Jenny.
No, I'm sorry. Keep going.
No, that's it. I mean, I think still should look at it. I think that everyone should look at it. I mean, there was one.
So the Wim Wenders film, Salt of the Earth, is about him.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I've heard, this is how I know that guy. I don't know any of his work, but yes, I definitely want to check it out. Jenny. You know our hearts. You've solved the puzzle in just a few minutes.
Hey, that's what I'm here for.
The photographer's eye. You've got it.
That's it.
So, real quick questions. Your first camera, Jenny.
Canon AE-1. Wait. I had a camera the name of, I don't know, actually. It was a 110 film. It was purple with a green button.
Plastic?
I mean, yes, clearly. It's so good. And it was the 80s, but I have no idea what it was called. I'm sure I could find it on the interwebs if I looked for it.
First photographs you remember taking?
A picture of our dog, Pepper, We lived outside, a beautiful white blondie dog. Picture of some flowers, some raspberries, pictures of my sisters.
When did you know photography was like an art form that you wanted to pursue?
I think I was probably about 13.
13? Was it an event or an experience, or was it just gradual?
No, you can ask my mom, who has lots of opinions about my artistic progression. So I decided apparently at about age 4 that I was going to be an artist. But I think I thought I was going to be a painter. But then about age 12, 13, I started to do photography, started to take photos of just things around me. And about age 13, I was like, this is the thing. And I think as I feel now, I think photographing is very calming to me and it's a social experience that I find comforting. So I think it was at that point as well.
I think most artists, most people, we have to sacrifice something. Like, I mean, I would love to just draw pictures of bears all day, and that would be my life, and that'd be really neat. But I'm a nurse practitioner. I don't draw cartoon bears all day. So you have a day job, but you also take pictures of weddings. How does that work for you? Do you approach it artistically, or do you approach it as like a 9-to-5 job? How are you approaching that sort of thing?
I approach it as like a 9-to-2 job. So for weddings, I mean, I think it's my passion about community that gets me through that process, because it is a very stressful job.
Sure.
It is a very difficult job. I don't know that I'll do it forever, but it's very rewarding. And it is about a community of people that come together for one day and have an experience together. And that to me is a beautiful thing. So the fact that I get to be a part of that is really special for most weddings. Occasionally there are weddings that I don't feel special about when I want to get away from those weddings.
Yeah, but most, you're not a divorce photographer then. You haven't been doing any divorces down at the courthouse lately.
Well, I would totally photograph that.
When I think back to my wedding and the photographer, I'm not a guy that's going to get his picture taken a lot, so I was very awkward. And I felt like every single shot he did was me sitting on a bench with my legs kind of spread open and my wife sitting in my lap. That's what he kept directing us to do. He's like, let's do that again on this bench now.
Because you guys are going to be having sex soon. We just got to get the photograph to suggest that now that you're married.
Here's where Laurel, your wife, stops listening.
Yep.
So what do you do with your couples to make them feel more comfortable and not have just like a ton of really awkward pictures?
I mean, the thing that I pride myself on is that almost more so than being a good photographer, I think I'm good with people. And I think that I can read their comfort level. And so if I see them reacting in a way that is uncomfortable, I stop that part and we start another process. The only reason I set things up in terms of like a forced portrait is to encourage an organic experience, and that's what I see as a positive from those kinds of photos, because they can be so boring. But I want it to be an organic, positive experience from people.
And Jenny, it's totally okay with me if you use that pose on your wedding couples. So okay. Just you get the male or who, you just get someone to spread their legs wide, sit on a bench, and you put the other one directly in front of them. And we have 5 or 6 shots like that are, hanging next to the leathers on our wall.
If it's not in your repertoire now, Jenny, make sure you add that pose to the list of like must get shots.
I got a wedding in 2 days that I'm going to add this to.
Yeah.
Boom. Done.
Just say, hey, hubby, spread them. Get down to it. All right.
Totally
so the other question I have, Jenny, you've worked with tons of couples. But anyway, we got listeners who might be getting married and thinking about hiring a photographer, et cetera. What advice do you have for couples in interacting with their wedding photographer?
Hire a wedding planner and a day of coordinator. Those are the two most important things that will help your photographer get what they need to make the day run smoothly and get the photos.
So have a plan and have someone in charge of coordinating it. That's
yeah,
not just like an aunt.
No, because I have I can't tell you how many times I've had to sort of take over and help people run their wedding. And I don't mind doing it. I love doing it. It's great. But it doesn't allow me to do my job to the fullest.
Yeah.
Having things in place so that your photographer can do everything on time is really ideal. And having good light. Those are the things. Those are the things you need.
Yeah.
In the world.
Jenny, that just made me think of the time that I bought a Tripit stroller from a guy, and the advice he gave me was hire a night nurse to feed the babies all night. And I'm like, yeah, I can't afford that, okay?
Yeah.
It's not happening.
Well,
we never hired the night nurse. We didn't do it.
But you could afford the stroller, right? And I think if you can afford the photographer, you can find someone to help you with the plan.
Yeah, okay.
Hey, pay your photographer to help you with the planning. Just pay her more.
There you go.
A time when you were pretending to take a picture of something else than you were really taking a picture of.
This is the ultimate question of surreptitious photography.
You know, I do this the most when I'm taking pictures of children on the street. Because I don't want to be a creep. I don't want to make them uncomfortable. I don't want their parents to be like, ooh, what a creep. But I am kind of being a creep, I guess. So, but I really like photographing children when they aren't quite aware that I'm photographing them, or they just are realizing that I'm photographing them, because children, as opposed to adults, have an openness, you know, that adults don't have, and they're more curious about what I might be doing. And so I find that much more interesting than photographing adults when they're not being observed.
Dave, you got a story?
Of course. I think, like any human being in the United States of America, we do this when we see some kind of amazing hair that you don't want to directly take the picture of. You don't want to call attention that you know that this hair is so out there, but you need to document the hair. I remember we were actually in Italy, in Venice. We were on like one of those boat taxis, and this guy got on, and he was wearing a toupee that looked like... it just looked like a coughed up hairball. It was unbelievable. I could not believe he had on his head. And I poked my wife. I was like, we gotta get a picture of that. And so I pretended to take a picture of her when really I got the toupee and it was awesome.
Dave, I got at least three stories. Still. But I'll tell one, the hair one. On our honeymoon, we were in San Francisco and there was a dude. We were in Chinatown and we went to this coffee shop, like tea place. There was these two old guys playing dominoes and one of them had an enormous, he was like bald except for like seven hairs, but he had combed those seven hairs like all the way around and like it was like spiral
nice.
Jetty of hair. And they were like plastered on his head. It was incredible. And so I just took like surreptitious photos of the back of his head while he was playing dominoes. And like, that was like the highlight of our honeymoon. Laurel and I loved it. So I still have that photo. And then the other one was us in the airport and we were on the moving walkway. And I swear that I saw the guy who was the inspiration for Magnum PI.
No.
He's probably 70. He was wearing like Robin's egg blue shorts with like a braided leather belt and a very loud, like perfectly matching Tommy Bahama's Hawaiian shirt that was tucked in. And then he had like perfectly coiffed white thinning hair. Like it wasn't, he was like old enough, but it was like it looked like Mitt Romney's hair kind of, but thinner and white. And it was like, boom, it was just, So I was like, got on behind him and he had like a straw pork pie hat kind of thing that was, he was carrying. He wasn't wearing it. He was carrying it. And flip-flops.
You know who's number one on his list of TV detectives. You know.
Yeah.
Columbo, definitely.
Yeah, definitely Columbo. The trench coat. The trench coat sold him. But anyway, so I definitely got a picture of him on this moving walkway with my iPod. But, I mean, those are great times in life when you can snap a picture of someone, a human specimen that's just amazing, like life inspiration.
I think you guys would appreciate that when I was in college, I would photograph every mullet I saw in Chicago.
That's an art school requirement, I think. They won't give you your degree unless you do. Chicago style. Chicago style hair is the best style of hair.
Tourists in Chicago is what it was.
Nice. People from Skokie. People from Normal. People from Romeoville.
Yes.
Was this one of your art shows? And if not, why? Why has this not happened yet?
The emotional experience was just called awesome.
It's probably, I should probably just make it into a movie. Very nice.
Yeah, Jenny. Tell Trent you're tearing up fear and you're replacing it with awesome.
Yeah.
Think of the community you could connect to on that, Jenny.
If only your viewers could see my face right now.
Yeah, that would be nice. All right, Jenny, thank you for being our artist in residence tonight. We've really appreciated you dropping some wisdom about photography. It is time to unchain some music. We play Unchained Melodies, where we play a couple of songs that have been moving us lately. Tonight, it's kind of a free theme. We just want to play songs that you've really been digging lately, things that have been earworms for you or that you've enjoyed. So each of us have two songs. Who wants to start us off?
I do.
Great, Jenny. What do you got?
Oh, yeah.
God, I don't even know how to say his name. Isn't that terrible? Mulatu Estake.
Uh-huh.
And the song is, the translation is From All the Time I Have Passed. It was Casa Lefukulu. But so it's this Ethiopian jazz that I've been listening to a lot for a while. And it's just like very relaxing. And I really like how the bass line comes in the beginning. It's really nice.
That's slick, Jenny. That was recorded like late 60s, early 70s from what Spotify's telling me.
Yeah. And the other thing I should say about it is that I found out about it because some of the songs off the same album were on the Broken Flowers soundtrack from the Dylan Jarvis film.
Nice. Okay. So Spotify, 2 months ago, recommended this musician to me, and I loved this song that I heard, and I was like, this is amazing. So I just knew the name just recently through that. So thanks for introducing me to a wider variety. Mm-hmm. Well, I want to keep us on the continent of Africa then. I've got a guy from Malawi whose name is Gaspar Nali, and this is like a summer jam. It's just upbeat and positive and relentlessly happy. It's called Abale Nduku Wuzeni. I slaughtered the pronunciation there, but he'll sing it here for you.
That's so fun. I never heard that before.
There's a lot to offer from Africa, huh? Great music tonight.
This guy, I think he's pretty obscure. He's just a guy. I think it's got a very small distribution in England on this. But he makes these homemade instruments. He plays a thing called the Babatoni, and it's like a 10-foot-long bass guitar that he makes himself. starts with this animal skin around a piece of wood, and then drums it or hits it with a piece of plastic or piece of metal, and so it's like got a couple of strings, and that's that kind of percussive ding 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 sound. Really, kind of just a one man band kind of thing. Go ahead.
Did he name the instrument himself? Because it's a terrific instrument name.
Babatoni.
Babatoni.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It feels like
sounds like an Italian like treat.
Italian grandmother.
No, an Italian treat.
Oh, a treat. Yeah.
Eat a babatoni.
All right, Dave. What are you gonna lay on us?
So this is a group called American Wrestlers. See if you can wrap your head around this. He's actually Scottish. He's not American. But the song's called "There's No One Crying Over Me Either."
That feels very the National influence to me.
Way more.
I think he just recorded that by himself, basically drum machine and stuff. But I like it. There's a ridiculous guitar solo in the middle that made my wife turn the radio down when we were listening to the song. But I still love it.
Yeah. Nice. Glad you're still appreciating the shredding guitar solos at your age, Dave. Never let it die.
Yeah, you only get old once you let yourself get old, Steele.
We're going to listen to some Smog.
You're speaking Dave's language. Dave, like, worships at the altar of Bill Callahan.
Yeah.
I didn't know that, but sure.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So we're going to listen to Hit the Ground Running.
Hit the Ground Running.
That really is right in my wheelhouse. Yeah, he's on the same label as the Silver Jew, who I love. And Drag City won't let him be on Spotify. I'm sure they got valid reasons and stuff, but I'd love to just listen to that guy while I'm working.
I mean, can Drag City just make their own Spotify then, please?
That'd be cool.
I would pay for that.
We're going to go with the Brazilian legend Tim Maia. The song's called Rational Culture. Forward to the, where they start singing. It's a 12-minute long song.
We are gonna rule the world. Don't you know? Don't you know? We're gonna put it together.
Don't you put it together?
We're gonna put it together.
Don't you put it together?
We gonna rule the world. Don't you know? Don't you know? We are gonna rule the world. Don't you know we're gonna put it together?
Don't you put it together?
We're gonna put it together.
Jenny, I think you'll especially love this. In the mid-70s, Tim Maia found this book called Universe in Disenchantment, which revolved around this cult called Rational Culture. He joined the cult, gave up drugs and red meat, and this song was directly inspired by the Rational Culture cult that he belonged to for a while.
Who started the cult?
Someone awesome, apparently, because that music. I mean, people say no good things come out of cults, but that's proof positive that they're wrong.
You guys both played songs that I felt would just really work well as the soundtrack to the number one detective show on TV. That one and the first one Jenny played, they both just made me feel like a crime was about to get solved.
Yes.
Nice. We did our work then. All right, Dave, close us out. What do we got?
Steel, you know how I love angry girls singing to me, so... That's what we got here. Camp Cope, and the song's called Done.
Dave, you have to admit, the cover art was what drew you in there, right? It's this adorable, cute little girl. Reminds you of your triplets in a hospital somewhere.
Yes, that's all. I'll profess love for any artist that puts a cute girl on the cover of their record. So that's a tip for anybody out there.
I was really surprised, actually. Her voice was prettier and more melodic than I expected from the musical lead-in. Yeah, it was a nice incongruity there.
Yeah, I really enjoy it. I've listened to Camp Cope a lot lately, and I do. Ever since I had three baby girls, I just love to hear women sing now. Like before, I won't listen, but now that's all I want to hear. I love it.
Your triplets melted your sexist heart, huh?
Yes. Destroyed the misogyny deep inside me.
Well, you had it coming to you, Dave.
I know it. I deserved it.
All right, Jenny, we always end a show with something called book wisdom. We share a passage from a book that's been meaningful in our lives. And you have a doozy for us tonight, I understand.
I have a book called The Poetics of Space by Gaston Bachelard.
Light beach reading for everybody who's listening at home, right?
So light. It's grad school light. So I'm just going to read one paragraph. And this book is literally about intimate spaces and how we connect to them and experience them. The little paragraph I'm going to read is about homes and houses. If I were asked to name the chief benefit of the house, I should say, the house shelters daydreaming. The house protects the dreamer. The house allows one to dream in peace. Thought and experience are not the only things that sanction human values. The values that belong to daydreaming mark humanity in its depths. Daydreaming even has a privilege of auto-valorization. It derives direct pleasure from its own being. Therefore, the places in which we have experienced daydreaming reconstitute themselves in a new daydream, and it is because our memories of former dwelling places are relived as daydreams that these dwelling places of the past remain in us for all time.
Wow. Our daydreams reconstitute themselves in us, and that's why that's beautiful.
It's good, right?
Yeah, I've never read that passage or considered that idea before, but I'm moved by it.
I think it's a great book.
I think that's a very valid section you could share with a professor if you're nodding off in class or just kind of staring off in the distance. Like, this is the validity of what I'm doing right now.
Yeah.
Daydreams are
or you
beautiful.
Don't come to class because you're at home.
I'm reconstituting the past spaces I've lived in. I don't know what your problem is. Yeah, that's great. Well, the time has flown so quickly, but the hour has come, and it's time to say goodbye. Jenny, you were a wonderful first-time guest. Thanks so much for joining us tonight on Off the Chain.
Thank you for having me. It was lovely.
Yeah, we appreciate it. It's nice meeting you.
You too. Off the Chain. It's Off the Chain.
Ever reviewed me in my current position. No one's ever been like, hey, you're doing okay with not killing people here.
I'm going to leave a review on your website at davejensenmalenurse.org.
Dr. davejensenmalenurse.org, okay?
No.